Welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, a host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. It seems like the Canadian province of Alberta, home to a massive tar sands industry that produces some of the globe's dirtiest and most polluting oil, has put the Pacific Northwest in its crosshairs. The province is partnering with the Canadian government, who recently nationalized the Kinder Morgan-owned Trans Mountain Pipeline, to ram through the expansion of the pipeline that would carry up to 890,000 barrels of oil per day from the Canadian interior to southwest British Columbia. Additional tar sands oil would make its way south to the Puget Sound refineries via a 69-mile pipeline called the Puget Sound Pipeline. Today, we talk again with Sightline Institute's programs director, Eric DePlace, about what it means for Oregon and Washington now that the Canadian government owns this unwanted pipeline that Kinder Morgan was about to walk away from. Eric, welcome back to Locus Focus.
Good morning, Barbara. Thanks for having me back on.
And it's always great to have you here. Well, a couple months ago, I got this posting from Dakota Case, who's a water warrior in Tacoma, and he basically said, well, now Justin Trudeau owns the Trans Mountain Pipeline. And I thought that was some kind of metaphorical crack. And then I found out, no, it's true. So I wanted, before we go into the rest of what's going on with pipelines here in the Pacific Northwest, I wanted to talk a little bit about your take on why Justin Trudeau bought the Trans Mountain Pipeline and a few other pipelines, as it turns out, that run towards Washington. What is going on there in Canada? We thought everything was going to be like really different under Justin Trudeau.
Yeah, it's a great question, and I think maybe I'll start with just a little bit of context for listeners who may not be completely up to speed with it. So basically, as you said in the intro to the program, Alberta is home to huge reserves of tar sands or oil sands, which is a particularly nasty kind of oil. Many people think it's the dirtiest oil on the planet. It's essentially sort of mined out of the ground and then chemically treated and diluted to make it flow like normal oil. Anyway, those producers in Alberta have been trying to find markets for their oil, and that was one of the drivers behind the big Keystone XL debate that we've been having for a long time. But the other part of that debate was about building this pipeline to the west through British Columbia to a marine terminal near Vancouver, and that's called there's an existing line there. It's called the Trans Mountain Line, and this Texas oil company has been proposing to triple the capacity of that line by building a new pipeline alongside of it. They ran into all kinds of trouble, all kinds of delay, escalating costs, blah, blah, blah. And it looked like this spring they were about ready to pull the plug and walk away. And then, very surprisingly, the government of Canada, with Justin Trudeau's very loud backing, paid $4.5 billion and bought the pipeline from Kinder Morgan, this Texas oil company, along with a few other assets. And so now we're in a super peculiar spot where instead of fighting a rather malicious Texas oil company, those of us who are trying to obstruct that pipeline are now basically trying to confront the Canadian federal government and Justin Trudeau, who has been a just an absolute cheerleader to build this oil pipeline.
Now, what was his position on Keystone XL? Because my sense about that, it was, let's say, a bit nuanced.
It was a bit more nuanced with that particular pipeline, but in general, he has been in favor of that. I mean, he's been on record multiple times saying that exporting Canadian oil is important to Canada and to his administration in particular. Now, there are a bunch of reasons for that that are probably worth unpacking on the show this morning. But you know, he's basically taken a sort of a deal where he said that in exchange for kind of coming up with some national carbon pricing policy, carbon tax in Canada, which, by the way, isn't really going to play out the way he was hoping. We'll get back to that in a second. He would be being able to delete a pipeline proposal from northern BC that PS wasn't going to get built anyway, that he would then sort of back the Trans Mountain Pipeline and sort of quietly back the Keystone XL Pipeline. And so I think at the end of the day, what's on the table is we're going to get a new oil pipeline, or maybe two, and none of the other stuff. So it's a pretty lousy deal, and I think it really casts a lot of shade on Justin Trudeau's alleged progressivism. Clearly, on the international stage, he's been, you know, I think, pretty good. Certainly, a lot better than other leaders we could name. But when it comes to oil extraction and to indigenous rights, pretty much a disaster.
Well, I find it interesting because one of the things that Justin Trudeau proclaimed when he became prime minister was that science is back in Canada. We're supporting our scientists. I mean, all because under the previous Stephen Harper government, I mean, it's kind of like what's going on here in the United States now. But I mean, science was a dirty word in that government and scientists were really being muzzled. So I wonder, how does Trudeau rationalize his support for science on the one hand, which includes acknowledging the dire threat of climate change and doing something about it, and the fact that he wants to promote the dirtiest fossil fuel industry in the world?
Yeah, I mean, it's a, you know, Canada is a super interesting political case study right now. I mean, if the United States weren't going through its own sort of bizarre machinations and Canada would be almost be more interesting in a way, but Stephen Harper.
What do you mean by that?
Well, I mean, Canada's politics are super tricky right now, and you know, I mean, we often, I think, in America, we tend to look to Canada as this kind of bastion of sort of you know, cosmopolitan international leadership, liberalism, but that's actually not a super accurate description of what Canadian politics is like. You know, as for one example of that, that actually bears on the Trudeau conversation, there was an election last week in Ontario, which is a, you know, very populous, like 40% of Canada lives in Ontario, fairly progressive province, and they just elected a guy named Doug Ford, who is basically a Canadian Trump. His first act was to try to take Ontario out of all of its climate agreements. He's a climate science denier. You know, his brother Rob Ford was famously the mayor of Toronto for a long time until he was caught on video smoking crack, literally caught on video smoking crack. Doug Ford, his brother, now is the premier of Ontario and really taking that province, likely to take it in a very nasty direction, and very similar to Trump in that kind of just nativist, sort of quasi-populist, angry return to some sort of darker elements of our political nature.
Well, as an aside, I mean, I used to really idealize Canada until I was up there in 2001. And I hadn't been up there in a number of years. And I was taking the ferries up the Sunshine Coast and looking at these massive clear cuts. And it was blowing my mind. And this was during the Harper government, I'm pretty sure. I mean, I think there was a liberal running the country at that time. Though the Social Credit Party was in charge of British Columbia, it sort of takes turns with the other more progressive parties. And thinking at the time, like, you know, where is there a place where there's some kind of environmental laws that will protect us against this? And I thought, well, the United States has better laws than obviously they have in Canada. So that was an eye-opener. But I think the other part to me that's really kind of confusing and disappointing, not that long ago, there was a kind of a revolution in Alberta, and the New Democratic Party took power, which is the most progressive party, be kind of the equivalent of the Green Party, I guess, in the United States. And Rachel Notley, I think, is the premier of Alberta.
Right. Yeah.
And she ran, I mean, she wasn't totally anti-tar sands, but she was talking about cutting back production of tar sands and really respecting the need to work on climate change and protect us against the dire effects of climate change. And my understanding is in this deal with Kinder Morgan that Alberta was really pushing the federal government of Canada to buy the pipeline, and that, in fact, Rachel Notley and the NDP in Alberta is promoting the Trans Mountain pipeline pretty vociferously.
Yes, I think that's all consistent with what I understand about how that deal happened. And so you're getting a tremendous amount of political pressure put on Trudeau and on the on his administration to build out that pipeline infrastructure so that they can extract and export more of that oil. And so, you know, the NDP leadership in Alberta has done, they've been better than the previous bad administrations, but still not great from the perspective of climate protection, not great from the perspective of Indigenous rights and so forth. And so, you know, end of the day, we're in this, sort of in this box where the oil industry in Canada, and look, those of us in the United States are familiar with the influence of the oil industry. Like, they in many places run the show. That's kind of true in Canada too. They have a tremendous amount of influence and a tremendous amount of money, and as a consequence, they've been effective at even sort of left or left leaning leaders are happy to do their bidding and try to build out this infrastructure that we simply cannot have in place. From a climate perspective.
Well, Andrew Negaforic, and he wrote a really excellent book about tar sands a number of years ago, and he referred to Alberta as a petrostate. But it seems to me that perhaps the entire country of Canada has now become a petrostate. Is that a sense that you're getting?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's not too much of a stretch at this point. I mean, it's I think that Nikiforuk's Andrew's point was really right about Alberta, and I think it's increasingly true of the country as a whole now, especially with the acquisition of this pipeline. It's unusual to see a big Western liberal democracy actually nationalize oil infrastructure like that and put that stuff all in the taxpayers' books. It's a tremendous expenditure of taxpayer resources to purchase something like this, and then it's also really changing the balance sheet from the perspective of risk. Previously, Kinder Morgan was on the hook for any unlimited costs from any oil spill from that pipeline. Canada actually has one of the few strong environmental laws I have is about oil spill risk liability or oil spill liability. Now, Kinder Morgan would have been on the hook for anything, any leaks from that pipeline or spills. Canada's now transferred all that risk onto taxpayers' books. So that's not something you do from a sort of fiscally prudent perspective. That's something you do if you're really interested in sort of becoming a petrostate, if you're really interested in sort of nationalizing the fossil fuel industry and making that your going concern politically.
Well, if you're just tuning in, you're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland and KBFG LPFM in Seattle. And today we're talking with Sightline Institute Programs Director Eric DePlace about how the Northwest is in the crosshairs of Alberta's tar sands. One of the things that really struck me is you're talking about the country nationalizing this oil infrastructure. And I'm thinking of another country that's famous for having a nationalized oil infrastructure. Well, Russia is probably one of them for sure, and Venezuela. And when Venezuela's oil industry was nationalized long before Hugo Chavez was president of Venezuela. But it seemed like while Chavez was running what looked like a good regime, it was good that the oil industry was nationalized. But then after things started falling apart, it looked really bad that it was. And I'm wondering if you can draw any parallels between the relationship between the government and the oil industry in Venezuela and in Canada?
Boy, that's a good question. I just don't know enough about what's happened in Venezuela nor to the oil industry there to really make a strong comparison. But you know, I mean, I think certainly, kind of, you know, on paper, at least from a distance, there are some similarities. I mean, in Venezuela, I mean, the entire refining sector was nationalized as well, and that's not Canada, especially in the West, does not really have any refining industry to speak of. So, you know, most of this is more like a delivery mechanism. It's designed to basically create an export outlet so that private producers can make a ton of money. And so, in a way, you know, you could argue, and this is probably debatable, but you could argue that sort of nationalizing the oil industry in a country like Venezuela and then capturing the profits from that and returning them to the public, that might actually sort of be a good thing. In this case, this is more like Canadian taxpayers making a very large purchase, transferring all of the risk onto the public balance sheet. But then who's going to make the money? That's going to be the private oil producers in Alberta, and that's going to be whoever, you know, they can basically sell that oil to on foreign markets. So this is almost more like a perverse form of capitalism, where taxpayers take the risk and the private companies take the profits.
Well, let's talk a little bit more about this company, Kinder Morgan, and why were they about to walk away from the pipeline just a few months ago?
Yeah, so good question. So Kinder Morgan is what in the business we call a midstreamer. That is, they don't drill the oil and they don't sell it at a retail basis, but they handle not just oil, but also coal and gas as a sort of a transporter. They have built pipelines and terminals and all the rest of that kind of stuff. They were actually a strange sort of story. They were kind of born out of the ashes of Enron when one of the leaders of Enron, Richard Kinder, left and spun up his own energy company. Lots of questions about how they've kept their books, not surprisingly. Anyway, so they've owned this oil pipeline, this existing Trans Mountain pipeline, for some years now, and had been hoping to build this second line alongside of it, about twice as big as the original one, but had been running into delay after delay, legal challenges from the indigenous communities, the First Nations up there, lots of obstacles from environmental activists, from local governments who don't want the thing to be built. They had trouble lining up investors. Their borrowing costs were going up. Kind of one thing after another was landing on their plate. And then also this new oil spill liability law that I just mentioned, where all the risks of a spill would have been transferred onto their books. it wasn't clear that they could actually demonstrate that they had enough cash on hand to be bondable for that pipeline route. So just things are looking worse and worse for them from a financial perspective. Now, they are a notoriously crafty company. Richard Kinder is definitely good at what he does. There's no doubt about that. He's a smart guy. And it looked like, kind of by the end of May, it looked like they had essentially gotten to a place where other people were going to be on the hook for most of their downside risk, but there was very little upside advantage to them building this thing, and it would have kind of tied up a lot of their cash. And there was always this question mark about, well, could they actually get the thing built, or was it going to get delayed by another year or two or three? And they're already like 3 or 4 years behind schedule or something. So they had said at the beginning of May, we're going to hit pause on this project. We're not going to do anything more on it. And we'll make a firm decision by May 31st. And we kind of thought that they might walk by May 31st. I think a lot of folks thought they would walk away from it. And instead, right before the deadline, that came back from, it was a Sunday afternoon, I think, or early Monday morning, got this big announcement saying, nope, Canada had stepped in, slapped down $4.5 billion on the nail, and taken ownership of the existing pipeline plus the expansion project plus some other assets that are connected to it. And Kinder Morgan got to put all that money in its pocket, walk away, and go home, turning a neat little profit for doing nothing.
Well, actually, your colleague Clark Williams-Derry wrote an excellent article a little while back after this transaction happened, and I just wanted to quote a couple things from it and get you to comment on it. He says, even though Kinder Morgan faced massive risks in moving forward with the pipeline, the company faced surprisingly little downside from walking away. And then he says at the end, in the end, Richard Kinder proved a consummate card shark, parlaying a no-lose position, simply walking away from a beleaguered and high-risk pipeline with a big win to himself. Meanwhile, Justin Trudeau has turned the people of Canada into Richard Kinder's marks. So what does Clark mean by that?
Yeah, so my colleague Clark, his full-time job is studying the finances and the economics of the oil and gas industry. And when he's quite brilliant, and when he's looked at this particular project, you know, I think what he said at the end there is a great analogy. Canada got taken, Trudeau got taken by Kinder Morgan, and what that means is that there are tremendous financial risks and very likely losses from holding onto that pipeline. Now, Kinder Morgan was actually in a position where it because of the way it had arranged its financing, that is financial support from the Alberta oil industry, from some investors who had bought an equity stake in the project, and some other factors, they weren't facing that much risk themselves. They were able to transfer most of the risk to other people even already, but when they were able to sell the thing to Canada, all that risk went to Canada. And they got to repay their investors and turn a neat little profit without having to face any risk whatsoever. So it looks like a pretty good deal for Kinder Morgan, pretty bad deal for Canada, and that was reflected, not surprisingly, in stock prices. As soon as they walked away, they got a nice little bump from the financial community who recognized what they had done.
But it seemed the other side of that was that they had spun off this shell company that Clark describes that was basically Kinder Morgan Canada, which was the Trans Mountain Pipeline and, I guess, the pipeline to go down to Washington and some other Canadian assets. And that once the stock market started going that day after the announcement of the sale, Canada was buying the company, buying the infrastructure, that Kinder Morgan Canada actually took a dive. And I think they lost 3% of their stock that day because it became aware, the investors in Kinder Morgan Canada became aware that all the profits from Canada, the federal government of Canada buying the pipeline, were going to go to Houston and not stay in Canada. So basically, right, the Canadian company seemed like it was pretty insolvent.
Yeah, that's a great description of it, and that's really consistent with the way they've operated in the past. Is they've tended to create small LLCs or limited shell companies to hold particular assets, and then they'll basically sort of take the profits back up to kind of the mothership, the Houston main company, and that's probably what the Kinder Morgan Canada thing is. is now kind of just a paper fiction at this point once the transaction is completed. So the Kinder Morgan Canada took a downtick in the stock market afterward, but the big Kinder Morgan went up.
So what does this mean for Canada now that it's saddled with, feels like, with this kind of giant white elephant?
Well, it's a good question. I mean, Trudeau is making no bones about it. He wants to build that pipeline. So we're in a position now where we've got the project backer for the pipeline is now the permitting agency for the pipeline. That's a really curious position. I suspect that they are going to do what they can to get the construction started in the near future. It's going to tee up an interesting conflict with the province. The province of British Columbia does not want the pipeline built, nor do the local governments of Vancouver and Burnaby. Burnaby is where the terminal is of the pipeline is located. And so there will be some kind of interesting political wrangling, but it seems reasonably clear that the feds have authority to build the project. Might get difficult, might get create some bad press, but on all likelihood, they'll stop building soon.
Well, the thing that I wonder about the most is that one of the things that really came up in all these struggles, both against Northern Gateway, the pipeline that would have gone across northern BC, and the Trans Mountain pipeline, is the resistance from the tribes, the First Nations mm-hmm. in Canada, and that they have actually, particularly the First Nations in BC, a lot more legal clout than even sovereign tribal nations in the United States have. And that looked like that was one of the unsurmountable obstacles that Kinder Morgan was facing. How does that change with it being the federal government now that's going to be forcing through the pipeline?
Yeah, Indigenous law in Canada is an interesting and subtle subject, and I'm actually not super well versed on it. But I think you're essentially right that in some respects, that First Nations communities have more legal authority because they don't actually have treaty settlements with the Canadian government, and so they occupy a somewhat confusing legal gray area where they kind of still are sovereign nations. It's sort of a sovereign unceded territory in a way. On the other hand, that's only kind of partially true. So where in the United States, most of the tribes have treaties, and while the treaties have been often violated, there's at least case precedent, and it's clearer what rights the tribes have and how they can pursue those rights in the courts. So, you know, we don't exactly know, and this happens a lot actually with gas pipeline projects in northern BC, where you've got fairly large land holdings by First Nations up there who may or may not want a pipeline to cross their land. Those have been some interesting cases to watch from afar, although I don't really understand the complexities of them. In southern British Columbia, where the pipeline would be routed, four of those First Nations mounted a legal challenge that appears to have been dismissed by the Canadian courts at this point. Now, it's not exactly clear whether that's the last card they can play, but certainly we expect there to be strong resistance from the First Nations in Canada, as well as actually from the tribes in the North Puget Sound region, who are very opposed to the pipeline because they share the same waters, the same fisheries, and the same sort of, you know, cultural homeland. And so there's no question that the indigenous population of the region is very opposed to the pipeline, which I think is an interesting irony because, you know, Trudeau really was trumpeting his own commitment to indigenous rights and, you know, kind of went to all this through all this hoopla and fanfare about how great he was going to be on it. And this is just a dagger at the heart of those communities. And it's really puts them in a very bad light, I think.
Well, yeah, it's a little difficult with the events of the last week and a half with Trudeau coming off looking so good compared to Trump. But I just wonder how to peel beneath the veneer of the very nice, reserved, cosmopolitan Trudeau is there a way to get him to actually make good on who he pretends to be? Or are we discovering he's more like a Bill Clinton?
That's a good analogy. I hadn't thought of that one myself. But I don't know. I've been thinking about this a lot, and I my suspicion is that it's gonna be tough. I think if Trudeau were sort of embarrassed on the international stage by building this pipeline and by his flouting of indigenous rights, I think that might bear on him somewhat personally. I have to confess that I'm quite disappointed in his leadership. He was a huge improvement over the previous Prime Minister of Canada, Stephen Harper, who was really a son of the Alberta oil industry. So Trudeau is no question an improvement over Harper, but still just incredibly disappointing. But I think on some level it's not really about his kind of personal wishes. It's the politics of Canada, and the politics of Canada are not good. The politics of Canada are driven to a very large extent by the oil industry, and so much like in the U.S. I mean, President Trump is a problem for us, but in a way, the problem isn't really about him as a person. It's about the fact that a large swath of the political establishment supports him in a fairly full-throated and increasingly alarming way. And so, the root of the problem is much deeper than Trudeau, in my opinion. I think if you replaced him with a different prime minister, we'd still have, kind of a similar circumstance.
I'm actually kind of thinking about Obama, who came out with a lot of promise. But for me, like, the reality of watching Obama be president was the president of the United States doesn't have that much power when it really comes down to it, even if it's somebody like Obama.
But that's right. I mean, I was increasingly disappointed with Obama's performance on a whole range of issues, but particularly with respect to the fossil fuel industry. He was not really our friend on a lot of those issues. He, amped up coal leasing and, expanded offshore drilling and, on and on and on. And, it was hard to see him as the kind of leader we had hoped he would be at the beginning. But, whether that's Obama's fault or whether that's the fault of the kind of the underlying politics of the country, to which, elected officials are usually pretty responsive if they're any good at staying in office, I think it's probably less about the person than it is about the tectonics of the politics that they're trying to govern. And so, in a way, I always try to say, it's a mistake to look too much to political leaders. They're good ones are really adept at figuring out where the parade is going and running to the front of it. And so it's on us to create the movement, to create the parade that's going in a different direction. And they'll get there when we are able to do the organizing and create the movement. They'll run to the head of it. But we are in a pickle because we don't have that yet in a big enough way.
Well, you're listening to Lectus Focus here on KWU Community Radio in Portland and KBFG LPFM in Seattle. And today we're talking with Sightline Institute's Programs Director Eric DePlace about a pipeline you've never heard of, because that's what we're about to talk about. So one of the interesting parts of the package of Kinder Morgan selling its Canadian assets to the Canadian government is that there are some pipelines that actually, or at least one, but maybe more, that run out of Canada down into Washington State. And then there's another pipeline that you wrote an article about that's a pipeline that runs into Snohomish County just north of Seattle. And I'm not sure if that was also a Kinder Morgan pipeline. That's a gas pipeline. It's a different story.
That's a gas pipeline.
Right.
Yeah.
So that's the one you've never heard of. But I think a lot of people haven't heard of the other ones that are the Kinder Morgan pipeline. So let's talk first about how this Canadian sale is actually, or Canadian purchase, is actually going to impact the fossil fuel development in Washington State. And then maybe a little bit later on, we can talk about the gas pipeline as well. So first of all, let's talk about this. So what was part of the sale, besides the Trans Mountain Pipeline? What other pipelines were involved?
Yeah, so in addition to the big Trans Mountain Pipeline, which is the main delivery of crude oil, you've got a jet fuel pipeline that spurs off that and takes jet fuel to the Vancouver airport. And then the other big piece of the puzzle was what's called the Puget Sound Pipeline. And so the Puget Sound Pipeline runs down to basically Whatcom County and then Anacortes to feed refineries there. And let me explain that in a second, but I want to zoom out for a moment. So Washington has five oil refineries. Four of them are big, and those are the four in the North Sound. And those refineries produce essentially all of the sort of consumer products, gasoline, jet fuel, diesel, butane, and so forth, that we use in most of the Northwest. So most of Western Washington, certainly if you're in the Portland area, most of British Columbia, if you're the gas that's in your car right now comes from those refineries. If you're in the Portland area, if you're in the Seattle area, those refineries are creating your product. Now, those refineries are supplied in a couple of different ways. They get oil tanker shipments coming down from Alaska and from some foreign markets. And then they also are fed by this spur of the Trans Mountain Pipeline. Like I said, it's called the Puget Sound Pipeline, and it comes down and takes this fork. One fork goes to the two refineries at Cherry Point in Whatcom County. The other tine of the fork comes down to Anacortes and feeds the Andeavor and Shell refineries at March Point there. And so those refineries are, they have been, some of them have retooled a little bit to get ready for an influx of heavy oil from Alberta. They would very much like more oil coming down from the pipeline. So now that Canada owns that pipeline too, which we believe is the first time that a foreign government has owned an oil pipeline, or maybe even any pipeline, in the U.S., and there is talk now that they will try to double the expansion, double that Puget Sound portion of the line. So they'll triple the one in Canada, double the one in the U.S., and keep those refineries, actually probably boost production at those refineries. And that's super troubling. So, you know, it could be that not only we're going to be fighting an expansion of the Trans Mountain Pipeline in Canada, we'll be fighting an expansion of the Puget Sound Pipeline into the North Puget Sound refineries. There's kind of a lot to say about that, but it does give us some jurisdiction to go after them. But again, we're going to be fighting the Trudeau administration, not a Texas oil company.
Now, I wonder, is there a difference for the tribes? Now, when the Trudeau administration tries to take on the tribes in the Salish Sea, south of the 49th parallel, they've got some pretty fierce opponents, particularly in the face of the Lummi, who have taken on major oil companies and won. So I'm just wondering if there's a different dynamic there, perhaps, between Trudeau disregarding the First Nations people in his own country and then trying to take on the Lummi Nation here in the United States.
I think there'll definitely be a difference. I mean, the Lummi were incredibly effective at fighting a huge coal project there. They've been instrumental in fighting some other projects as well. And they'll be acting with great solidarity from many of the other tribes on the Salish Sea. I think the principal difference is that the Trudeau administration is going to have to deal with state and federal environmental law in the U.S., and that's going to be a lot more difficult for them, frankly, than it is in Canada. Getting that pipeline expanded would create many opportunities for delay and for driving up costs. I am not saying that I want them to try that expansion, but I would be very involved in opposing it, and it would be a ton of fun in a way to be able to fight a project like that and to be able to draw out for people just how nasty the industry is and just how important it is that, look, we have all the oil industry that we need. We have all the oil infrastructure that we need. We have too much of it. We need less of it. We don't need to build more of it that's going to last us for 50 more years or 70 more years. And I think having a public conversation about that, it tends to have some pretty positive benefits. We can do that in Washington State in a way that it's harder to do, I think, in Canada.
When you say that it's fun, I mean, what do you mean by that?
Well, you know, I think so. This sort of project that I've worked on for the last many years, we call it the Thin Green Line, has been kind of the Northwest resistance to coal, oil, gas projects, methanol projects, and in every community where we have fought these projects, we have seen this tremendous kind of grassroots organizing, tremendous energy, tremendous participation in civic structures. Port commissions races get super interesting. Zoning gets really interesting. And people show up, and thousands of people show up to make clear that they don't want their community to become part of the fossil fuel industry. And that's been really fun. Vancouver, Washington is, one of my favorite examples of that happening. They fought back a big oil trend project there recently. We saw, certainly a zoning change in Portland that was extremely exciting to watch. And we've seen this up and down the Northwest Coast. So, there's a part of me that kind of welcomes a confrontation with the industry because when we're able to have a public conversation about the costs and benefits, we win almost every time. People do not want to turn the Northwest into a superhighway for oil and gas. They just don't. And so I you know, often welcome, let's have a big public debate. Do we want more coal in the Northwest or do we not? Do we want more oil pipelines? Do we want more gas pipelines? People don't want it. And because they see that the future should be built around clean energy and that we do have to take climate protection seriously. And so, you know, when we take those decisions away from kind of the back rooms of federal government or the back rooms of the oil industry and have them in public, that's generally good for our movement.
Well, I'm wondering if this movement is on the verge of growing to new areas. I mean, in Portland, Vancouver was interesting because Vancouver was kind of like fossil fuel neutral before the oil train debate. And it was, I think, something nobody ever thought about. But once they did think about it, it really it galvanized the community. Portland, Vancouver, Seattle, Vancouver, BC, and Seattle are at least have a reputation for being very green-minded, though there are certainly strong forces within each city that I think are backing fossil fuel, particularly in Vancouver, BC, from what I can see. But I'm thinking, what does it mean to take this struggle to a place like Tacoma, which has a very long history of being industrialized, polluted, a strong military, oil, fossil fuel complex going on? Do you see that if this change is happening in a place like Tacoma and how that might really maybe reshape the rest of the region?
Yeah, I'm glad you brought up Tacoma. As you know, Tacoma is like my favorite place in the Northwest right now. And it's because it illustrates this dynamic really well. I mean, so, you know, Tacoma has this long legacy of being really invested in heavy industry, smelters, oil refineries, a whole bunch of other components of the fossil industry. And, you know, if we rewind the clock by, like, I guess, 2 or 3 years, there was a proposal in Tacoma to build the biggest methanol refinery anywhere in the world, by a long shot. So it was just an enormous petrochemical facility. And that proposal queued up an outrageous debate in Tacoma about whether that was Tacoma's future or not. And it got so heated that the project backers just pulled out. They closed up shop and said, we can't get this thing built here. And they viewed it correctly as a political litmus test. You would have been nuts as an elected official in Tacoma to have backed that project by the time we were done with it. So they pulled up stakes and they left town. There are some other projects that are hotly contested in Tacoma. Tacoma LNG, which is a relatively modest size liquefied natural gas facility, very sort of a lightning rod issue in Tacoma politics right now. But you know, recently we saw the city council vote unanimously to enact a moratorium that would prevent the construction of any new fossil fuel facility in the industrial port area. The fact that Tacoma unanimously put a moratorium on that construction, that kind of construction, we'll get it renewed, we're going to get it rezoned, that is a huge step forward. Now, it could have gone farther.
I want to interject for a second. So how does the the Puget Sound Energy's LNG tank that is almost finished being built, how does that fit into that moratorium since that's being built without any permits?
Yeah, that's a great question. So that project was already underway when the moratorium was passed, so it was exempted from the moratorium. Lots of folks feel that the moratorium didn't go far enough by capturing that plant, and possibly that's true. I think it would have been you kind of got to game out the politics of like whether we could have gotten the votes for it or not with that plant covered. But certainly that plant is a bad idea. I oppose the construction of that plant. It's still being contested. And as you just mentioned a moment ago, it's missing one of its key permits. It's missing a key clean air permit, but they've essentially completed construction on the thing at this point. And so it's teed up a very bizarre circumstance in which a fossil fuel company has built out a plant without having the permits in place for it. Horrible public policy, horrible precedent. You know, whether there's an opportunity for litigation or some other way of opposing it, I think is a question mark. But certainly state regulators are looking very askance at that project now because it's not guaranteed that they're going to get that permit. The Puget Sound Clean Air Agency still has jurisdiction over issuing that permit. If they don't issue it, they can't operate the plant. So lots of question marks around that, but it's a very contentious project. Staunchly opposed by some members of the community and by the tribe, and a lot of the kind of elected class has dug their heels in favor of it, which I think is unfortunate.
Well, we'll be talking a lot more about that project next week, actually, with your colleague, Tariq Powell.
So, yes, and Tariqa is the world expert on that project. She knows more about it than anybody.
So, well, stay tuned for that. Well, you're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland and KBFG LPFM in Seattle. And today we're talking with Eric DePlace, who's with Sightline Institute. And now we're going to hear about the pipeline that you never heard of. So what is this pipeline that you wrote about a few weeks ago?
Yeah, so one of the things I've been trying to do is we've been focused for years and years here on the big fossil fuel export projects, so these huge proposals to ship coal and oil, gas abroad. What I'm trying to do now is pay more attention to the smaller and more subtle ways that the fossil fuel industry is always trying to expand in the Northwest. I would prefer to phase it out over time and move to a clean energy future. Obviously, the gas industry and the oil industry has a different game plan. So I wrote about recently a pipeline that very few people have heard of, and it's called the North Seattle Lateral Expansion. It's kind of a mouthful, but it's in Snohomish County, which is the county just north of the county Seattle is in, King County. And it's basically, an eight-mile replacement project. So they're going to take out an existing gas pipeline and replace it with a new pipeline, but it just happens to be three or four times as big as the existing pipeline. And it is a pretty good example of the way that the industry is constantly trying to grow. Any opportunity for an upgrade or a safety enhancement or anything like that, they will often try to come in and use that as a stalking horse for expansion. Now, the reason that project is problematic for a bunch of reasons, but one of them is that if you kind of did the math and said, well, if you used all the new capacity in that line, where would it go? If you use all the new capacity in that line, it would increase the state's greenhouse gas emissions by like 3% just with one 8-mile replacement, quote-unquote, replacement project. You could boost the entire state's emissions by 3%. We do not need that. We do not need that kind of capacity. If they're going to replace it, they should replace it with something smaller, in my view, or not replace it. We need to be transitioning away from fossil energy to cleaner sources. That's kind of the nickel summary of that gas pipeline, but also backed by Puget Sound Energy, same folks who are behind the project in Tacoma. It's our somewhat nefarious Western Washington gas utility.
Let's actually talk a little bit more about Puget Sound Energy, because I think for listeners outside of the Puget Sound area, people don't know what it is. So who is Puget Sound Energy, and what area do they service?
Yeah, so their service territory is kind of it's a patchwork quilt, but they provide electrical power to much of Western Washington, not the older cities, but to the suburbs particularly, and then the gas utility to practically all of Western Washington. Well, I mean, good chunk of it in the Puget Sound area. So, electric and gas utility, they have been kind of a problem child for years now. They used to operate two generators at a coal-fired power plant in Montana called Colstrip. So they were powering much of suburban Seattle with coal power. They built out this liquefied natural gas facility at Tacoma without permits. They've got this the pipeline expansion I just talked about in Snohomish County. And just kind of bit by bit, they are always trying to expand the reach of the fossil industry. Kind of while marketing all their greener stuff. So they've got a few renewable projects as well, and they tend to market those a lot. They're actually owned by an investment group called the Macquarie Group, which is an Australian big corporation. And while they market themselves as this kind of green local utility, in actual fact, they are often just a stalking horse for the fossil fuel industry.
Now, like Portland General Electric, weren't they once a locally owned utility?
They were, and Portland General Electric is not a bad analogy, actually, but no longer are they locally owned. So they now, and one of the things that's interesting, too, is that I haven't done the analysis for Oregon, but I probably should, but we tried to look at political spending by the gas industry. So like if you are a utility that uses gas, if you're a pipeline company, producer, anyone, how much is the gas industry spending on politics? And PSE spends as much as the entire rest of the gas industry combined in Washington politics. I mean, they give money to practically everybody, and they'll often fund opposing candidates in the same race. And so, you know, if you can look kind of up and down the ticket, practically anywhere where they've got an interest and they've got money in the game, which is part of the reason why they've been so effective, actually, because they are very adept at playing politics in Washington. And interestingly, they've also been an opponent of public power, and so there have been a few cases where little jurisdictions have, once they switched ownership from being local to being purchased by the Macquarie Group, a few jurisdictions tried to take control and start a public power district, and PSC funded these kind of AstroTurf campaigns, sometimes setting spending records in those jurisdictions, and successfully stopped every one of those movements. So that they retained control of energy sales there.
Sounds a lot like Portland General Electric in the past, too, which spent a lot of money defeating public power here back in the 80s. I guess unlike PGE, though, I mean, PGE is now again locally owned after its disastrous marriage to Enron. PGE seems to be a bit more of a mixed bag, but they're still promoting a lot of gas projects, even though they claim to be. And let's talk about that, because this is the thing that's really frustrating about utility companies. I've been on Puget Sound Energy's website a number of times and seen how you would think that they are a completely green company. Same with Northwest Innovation Works, who is promoting, trying to build the methanol refinery in Kalama. They just talk about how these are green projects. And in fact, I was told a story by some Tacoma activists about the sustainability fair that happened in Tacoma a while back. And Puget Sound Energy had this big display at the just as you walk in, and they basically did a drumming circle by it to let people know this is not sustainability. And I think their little bullying that they're giving away was all like plastic stuff. So let's talk about the disconnect between these utilities pretending to be green companies and what they're actually doing.
Yeah, so that's a great setup. I have a slightly optimistic read of this, which is that, you know how earlier I said we need to kind of create the movement, we need to create the parade, and the elected officials will run to the head of it. In parts of the Northwest, we're actually creating that parade. Like we have actually successfully made the case that clean energy is important, that climate protection is important, that we don't like the fossil fuel industry. Like that's all kind of in the cultural mix. We kind of have some sort of broad agreement about that, which is encouraging. And so, but what's interesting now is when you have PSC as a utility or Northwest Innovation Works, and frankly, we've actually seen this with the oil companies too. They get it. They're not complete idiots. And so when they want to expand or when they want to market themselves, they get that in order to do that, they have to come up with some kind of patina of environmental responsibility or some kind of veil of greenness in order to make the thing work. And so increasingly we're seeing them pitch and describe and name their projects as if they're environmental improvement projects, which is not very often. One example actually is that one of the refineries up at Anacortes, they're trying to build on a whole petrochemical production unit at the refinery. And what they named that project the Clean Product Upgrade, which is sort of like it's a brain teaser, because like how is producing a petrochemical called xylene for plastics manufacturing in China, in what sense does that have clean product upgrade? And it's using fracked oil too. So that game plan we're seeing more and more often nowadays. But in a way, it's a sign of a success for our movement. We just have to not let ourselves get duped by the marketing materials.
Well, I think we've come a long way from places along the Gulf Coast. Last time I was in New Orleans, I learned about all these newsrooms where you can't use the word climate change, and the oil companies have such a stranglehold over conversation and dialogue in the Gulf Coast and in the New Orleans area. So yeah, they don't bother with too much greenwashing down there. But I have concern that greenwashing can also be really deceptive. I was told in Tacoma last time I was there by several people that Puget Sound Energy is spending $80,000 to $90,000 a month to promote the Tacoma LNG project, and they're way outspending the opponents. The opponents don't have that kind of money to spend, so they have this huge marketing as well as buying elections, they have a huge marketing fund that they just kind of, you know, throw out and throw in the way of their opponents. How do we not get sucked up by that? Or how do we, maybe we don't, but how do we reach people who are potentially going to be swayed by this kind of greenwashing?
Yeah, it's a good question. And I mean, the PSC spending that kind of money into Tacoma is so disheartening. Because I often greenwashing is effective. And in addition to the greenwashing, they're spending money, on local races and state races and federal races. So they tend to have access to our elected leadership too. I think it's one of those things where we really have to kind of go back to the bread and butter of what the environmental movement has always been about, which is it's going to be local organizing, it's going to be grassroots activism, it's going to be community journalism like this station, it's going to be progressive think tanks like Sightline Institute, it's going to be NGOs and tribes, and it sounds like a cliche, but I really do believe that the people powered movement, we've demonstrated this, that movement has the power to stop huge projects, huge well-financed, politically connected projects. That movement has done it again and again over the last decade in the Northwest. And, you know, at this point, I was a pessimist about the movement for a long time until it kept winning over and over again, stopping, you know, oil trains and coal terminals and petrochemical plants and kept doing it. And, you know, nowadays I would put my money on them every time. So I think that, you know, the antidote in Tacoma and everywhere else is going to be that kind of grassroots-based people power that stands up and says, look, this is the marketing material is bogus. Now, there are some other things we can do, I think, to kind of unwind the influence of PSC. And for me, a lot of that has to do with a little bit of public shaming, actually, and calling them out for who they are and helping to get our elected officials to say no to their money. That would be helpful.
So how do we do that?
Well, I think simply pointing out that, like, if you're taking money from PSC, you're taking money essentially from the fracked gas industry. And that, you know, if you're taking money from PSC and you're supporting the Tacoma LNG project, or if you're supporting that pipeline expansion project, that's really problematic. It's going to be harder and harder, I hope, in the future for folks to say that they are interested in clean energy or that they're a climate leader if they're also taking money from PSE. And I will say, too, as a caveat, right now that we have real serious climate champions, people who've done progressive politics in a very serious, sincere way, who are funded, but who get little bits of money, and sometimes lots of money from PSE. So I don't want to cast too many aspersions, but we got to change that. We got to make it the case that taking money from PSE, as long as PSE is backing fracked gas expansions, that's no longer considered an okay thing to do. Just like you wouldn't take money from Exxon, probably our elected officials shouldn't be taking money from PSC either.
Well, I guess I think about a role model I met Richmond, California, and how that city was completely controlled politically and socially and economically by the Chevron refinery that's been there since before the city was incorporated, and how things have were changed in the last 15, 20 years because of a strong coalition of progressives who basically took over the city government. And now they're moving on to state legislature and other higher offices. And I've been trying to connect the Richmond Progressive Alliance with people in redefined Tacoma, because I think Tacoma could get some really good lessons from Richmond. And I wonder if you have any other thoughts about other ways to build those kind of alliances.
Yeah, I love the idea of connecting Tacoma and Richmond. I mean, there's so many similarities. I don't know. I mean, my sense is that that every one of these communities that fights a fossil fuel project, there's not really a cookie cutter. It kind of depends on the local leadership and the local dynamics. But I do think if I could give advice to the movement, that my advice would be this: we often don't recognize how powerful we are and how successful we are, and I think sometimes we do ourselves a disservice by not realizing how much progress we're making. So when I look in particular at the zoning changes that have happened in, you know, at this point, 7 or 8 Northwest cities that have zoned fossil fuels out, that's huge. That is almost inconceivable if you go back 5, 6, 7 years. And we're doing it now. And we're doing it pretty seriously. That's big. The fact that we've beaten back big projects, almost all of them, successfully, is big. And so I think that we should operate more from a place of of confidence that we can continue to win more folks over to our side and continue to win these big fights, and operate less from a place of perceived powerlessness, because we're not powerless. The fossil fuel industry is worried. They don't think they can build projects in the Northwest. They should be worried about that. That's why they were using all this greenwashing to begin with. So anyway, I'm a little bit optimistic about it, I guess.
Well, I'm glad to hear your optimism, Eric. It's a good way to end the show. So thanks a whole lot for telling us we can do it.
Thanks, Barbara. I appreciate it.
We've been talking this morning with Sightline Institute's program director, Eric DePlace, and you've been listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland and KBFG LPFM in Seattle. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed, or you want your friends or family to hear this show, you can listen to it online or download the audio later this afternoon on our website, kboo.fm/locus-focus. Next week, I'll be talking with Tarika Powell, also with Sightline Institute, about where all that frack gas they want to bring through the Northwest is coming from. My engineer is Patsy Kohlberg. I'm Barbara Bernstein. We're going to go out with some music by Joni Mitchell. Thanks for listening. Just